So this is an ancient practice, Angus. Goes back millennia in China.
No, I mean, I think it was adopted in the middle of the 19th century with the civil service exam and so on.
Right.
And then early in the 20th century, they had this idea that you could have a very selective meritocracy. So most kids had to leave school at 12, but they let one or two kids go on. So like in my dad's school, he was kicked out when he was 12. And one kid in the class, because these schools were, you know, providing manpower for mines, not providing, you know, a ladder for people.
Right.
And so, and it's interesting that even the left supported that very strongly in the early years of the 20th century. The Fabians were for a very narrow meritocratic ladder. And the idea that there should be mass education as part of citizenship really came along somewhat later and was contested well through my lifetime.
I also hear, continuing with that argument, that more recently in the 80s and 90s, when it came to university admissions, the left also supported standardized testing because that was the only way to make sure that it wouldn't just be, you know, upper class toffs getting into Oxford and Cambridge, which
it still is by and large.
It's become so crazy.
Well, I was at Cambridge. We were very proud of our competitive exams, which we graded anonymously because we wanted all kids to have an equal chance of getting them. And then I remember one year we opened the envelopes and the top 12 places all came from the same school.
Sure.
So we will be starting in a minute. So I'm just going to mute you all, switch off my camera, and then I will click broadcast. So if we can not talk for the next few minutes, and then Andres, I will let you know once we're ready.
Okay, and I get a message from you in the chat, right?
Yes, on the chat, yeah. Okay, right, great.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, depending on where you might be in the world. My name is Andres Velasco. I'm the Dean of the School of Public Policy at the LSE. And we are here to help launch and also discuss an exciting new book entitled Randomized Controlled Trials in the Field of Development, A Critical Perspective. And we are joined this afternoon on this online panel by two of the book's authors and editors, Isabel Guérin and François Roubaud, and by two very, very distinguished discussants and commentators, Professor Angus Deaton from Princeton University, a very well-known and influential economist, and a Nobel laureate, which is particularly relevant on this day that, in fact, the Nobel Prize for Economics this year was announced. And we also have joining us Professor Lan Pritchett, for many years of the Harvard Kennedy School and nowadays at Blavatnik School at Oxford. The role of RCTs in development is both an important and often a controversial subject matter. And that is exactly what we're going to be talking about today. I'm an academic who write papers, but I was also not too long ago a minister in the government of Chile making hard decisions. And nowadays I am a dean of the School of Public Policy, struggling with the hard questions of what it is that students should be learning so that they can go off and be effective policymakers. And this book, and I suspect the discussion we're going to have today, will examine and tackle all three questions. First of all, there's no question, I think, that the RCT movement has produced some very good papers, but the issue of whether they are the papers on the right subjects, on the most important topics for development, is one, among others, that remains controversial. But even more importantly, there is the question of whether RCTs actually help ministers make decisions, hard decisions on difficult policy topics. I was a minister in charge of macroeconomics, not so much of micro, so maybe I'm not a good test case, but I was once asked, you know, had I ever used evidence from an RCT in making a decision as a minister? I will confess that I scratched my head for a very long time and I had to answer no. And last but not least, as we think about curricula for students, we have, or at least I have, many of us have to ask the question, this is an important methodology, how much of it should we teach students? What other empirical methodologies should we also teach students so that they leave our schools well-equipped to look at data, to assess empirical evidence, but also to make important decisions on important subjects? So this is not just about writing the best papers for the best journals. It is actually about a method for making development better. And this is not a new technique or a new approach. You know, the widespread use of RCTs in development began about 25 years ago. So this is a very good time for an overall assessment, perhaps a critical assessment, and that is exactly what this book provides. So the rules of engagement are as follows. We're going to give Isabelle and François, the two editors, about 15 minutes to tell us about the book and the main points the book makes and the main conclusion it arrives at. And then we're going to give Lan Pritchett about 15 minutes to present his views and his reactions to the book. And then Angus Deaton will also have about 15 minutes to bring his views and his research to the conversation. So without further ado, let me hand it over to Isabelle and François so they can tell us about RCTs in the field of development, a critical perspective. Isabelle, over to you. Thank you.
I think that I will begin.
All right, François, over to you then.
Okay. So thanks a lot for inviting us, Andres, and the School of Public Policies of LSE for the launch of our new collective book with two co-authors, illustrious co-authors. It's a pleasure and an honor. And for this very short introduction to the book, we will divide ourselves with Isabelle in two parts. The first one will be me with the long march to the book. I will represent the world before and probably to the bad cop. And Isabelle will give you the main takeaways of the book, representing the world after and the good cop. So what about our motivation? The book is one key output of a long-run research program which started in 2012 and with the illustration of the figure here, that is the exponential rise of the gold standards in impact evaluation, RCTs, and maybe at the same time some eviction over other methodologies. So for us, it was quite intriguing. Was it a real revolution or just a new fashion? So we launched this research program in 2012, and we had a trigger with the AFD-EUDN conference in 2012, where there was sort of a deaf mute dialogue in this conference entitled Evaluation and its Discontent between the pro-RCTs panelists and the others. So no call, no funding, just a free research program with colleagues. And our research question were what are the methodological property of RCT? Are they really the holy grail? And why? Why this road to global success? Is it the only stairway to heaven? The core team of our group is Florent, not here today, a political scientist, evaluator, and geek, which is important at time of making a full replication from the donor's side. Isabel, socioeconomist, qualitative approach, and from the academia, and myself, economist and statistician, more on the quantitative side and also from the academia. So a diversity of background and approaches to try to tackle the issues. What were our first results? We published a series of papers trying to assess RCTs in development and globally the Randomista movement. From which point of view? So we explore three dimensions of RCT nexus. The first one, the most classically theoretical issues, RCTs in theory, internal and external validity, in line with many others and many more qualified others as quoted here. And we call that doing the math. Maybe more original, the two and third point, second and third. First, we developed an empirical critique of RCT in practice. Our experiments are conducted in the field, and that is doing the cooking. And you know, as Frenchmen, as French people, how important is the cooking for us. And the last point is investigate the political economy of what we call the scientific business, the pro-RCT movement and Randomistas. And that is doing the accounts, both financial, even if we can do not what all what we want, and also symbolic. What are the conclusions we draw from this first phase? There are three sets of conclusions. The first one is RCTs are a sound tool to assess the causal impact, but first, it is limited to a yes-no question about the impact and how much, but not the channels, not the why, which question more broadly, what is the theory of causation we are speaking about. The second limitation is that RCT should be conducted by the book under certain conditions, and these are rarely met in the real world. No book in the field, and there is no virgin territory in the global south, as it was already the case in time of conquistadores. Second, three of the Randomista's claims are, according to us, illegitimate. First, RCT is only rigorous or synonymous scientific method in town. The second point is that the RCT can explain all what works and what doesn't in development. And finally, the idea that multiplying RCT on all topics and tropics will allow to overcome external validity challenges. And that is what we call the hegemonical project. And the third conclusion is about the analyzing the success, which is based on a market domination strategy, a hegemonic position and sort of rent captures. A successful business model in different fields, academia, donors, public audience, mainly in the north, and the corresponding Randomista hubris. Then we began the second track, the second phase, in two parallel tracks. The first one was the thorough investigation of RCTs on microcredit. From the bottom, analyzing in detail one vocal RCT conducted by JPL on microcredit in Morocco. And the second, a more broader view on the last word on microcredit, which represents the special issue of the American Economic Journal, Applied Economics, about microcredit. And so we published, or we wrote, three papers. The first one is a full replication. When I say full, not a push-bottom replication, and that is where the geek skills of our colleague Florent was great to reproduce all the codes from this RCT, thanks to the author, to make them publicly. And our main result was, said a bit harshly, garbage in, garbage out. The second paper was to go beyond the scene, and with privileged documentation we got to see how has been conducted this RCT in the field and try to explain the mess we found in the full replication. And the last point was extending the scope of our investigation to the whole special issue of the six RCTs conducted in parallel with harmonized protocols. And the conclusion is that the conclusion we found for the Morocco RCT still hold. The second step, maybe from the top, is a collective book we are discussing today or presenting for the first time, called, as has been said by Andres, Randomized Controlled Trial in Development, a Critical Perspective, published by Oxford University Press. The book was supposed to be published the 8th last week, but we are not sure that it has been done. So, for a very brief presentation of the outline of this book, we have more or less 4 or 5 blocks of chapters, 12 chapters, to get protected. First, we've got a preface by Angus Deaton and an epilogue by James Ekman. And also, it may be a sort of a shock of the Nobel Prizes. Then we've got a bunch of 3 chapters, which are mainly an overview of the potential of the method, a broad perspective, with both critical views and support of RCTs. Then we've got a second block on sectoral approach, trying to read this overview to practical cases in global health, in sanitation, and in microfinance, microcredit. A third block of chapter is about the political economy with the special lens of the one hand, in the one hand of the rhetoric of RCTs and the economics, the poor economics linked to RCTs. And the second paper is about the position of the pro-RCT movement within the broad community of evaluator, professional evaluator. And then the fourth block is about we have the limitation, but we should also make some proposal. And so there are some views about the ethics consideration and also how to better use the information to try to get improved RCTs, which is also by Eva Vivalt and also some elements of the epilogue by James Ekman. And at last, we've got a postface with 4 interviews of policymakers, 2 high-ranking officers in France from the academic and donor community, and then 2 specialists, high-ranking officer too, in policymaking in India. So that is the global view on the book. And now I give the floor to Isabel for the takeaways. Thank you.
Good evening to all of you. Good morning. And thank you so much, Andres Velasco, for this great opportunity. I'm not going to summarize the book. This is simply impossible given the diversity and the richness of the contributions. So I'm just going to highlight a few points. The initial idea behind this book was to extend the scope of our own work and to establish a dialogue between different disciplines, a dialogue between scholars and policymakers, but also a dialogue between different visions regarding the scope of RCT. Initially, we invited a number of randomistas. By randomista, I mean researchers defending the superiority of the method over all others. At the end, only open-minded RCT users responded positively, and we sincerely thank them to have played the game, which means that a real controversy with randomistas themselves still need to be done. And in the introduction of the volume, which reflects only the standpoint of the editors, we try somehow to draw our own lessons of this dialogue. In fact, it is an attempt to answer the following question. Ultimately, what opposes the advocates of RCTs and its critics? What are the areas of disagreement? Or to put it differently, what are the terms of the debate? 3 points here, which are clearly articulated: epistemology, politics, and ethics. So the very first issue has to do with epistemology, with here a certain form of positivism, or even sometimes scientism, against what could be called pragmatism. Are we looking for universal answers, or are we looking for reasonable explanations, limited in time, limited in space, attentive to the diversity of situations, including within specific groups? As many of you probably know already, the claim of randomistas to universality has already been strongly criticized because of that inability in many cases to demonstrate external validity. The bias of the so-called average result has also been widely discussed and criticized. Something which has been less discussed and which is in line with our previous work regarding the empirics of RCTs is the gap between the protocol in theory and the protocol in practice. Do we focus primarily on a theoretical protocol able of measuring causality and statistical inference? Or are we concerned about the feasibility of the protocol, the way it is implemented in the ground, in the real world? Are we also concerned about data quality? And here, randomization might work well in theory, but in practice, given the multiple challenges faced by the implementation in the ground, this is not the case. And in a number of situations, field constraints contradict the assumption of the statistical theorems used for inference. And deviations between protocol and implementation can be observed all the way down the knowledge production line, at the level of sampling, at the level of intervention itself, which in some cases are artificially transformed to meet the requirements of the protocol, at the level of data collection, at the level of the interpretation of the results. In theory, the result is a simple comparison of average. In practice, the interpretation of the results involves multiple hypotheses, and even, in some cases, an art of rhetoric that proves to be extremely persuasive. And the requirements of the theoretical protocol have critical implications for the type of intervention RCTs can study and the type of questions they can answer. And this brings us to the second crucial aspect of the debate, which is a political one. What do we mean by development? In short, do we consider development and the fight against poverty as an aggregation of private goods and macro interventions, or is development first and foremost seen as a matter of transformative politics, institutions, infrastructure? And here, regardless of the worldview of the randomistas, the technical constraints of RCT protocol force them to focus on micro intervention and private goods. I will say no more here. This is a key argument of Land Pritchett. And let me just say the fact that the book provides a number of very concrete examples in the field of global health. Do we look at financial incentives and mosquito nets, or do we look at complex and systemic health systems? In the field of sanitation, do we look at the use of latrines, or do we look at the infrastructure of human waste flows? In the field of governance and public administration, do we look at random inspections or do we look at wake state capacity? For the reasons mentioned earlier, deviations between protocol and between official protocol and real protocol, the ability of RCTs to measure impact is in fact rather limited. And quite often, RCTs are rather used to compare different modalities of a specific intervention. For instance, agriculture fertilizer combined with training or without training. And then RCTs measure the outcome in terms of intervention take-up. And this allows them to test behaviors. If we change prices, timeframes, information, assistance, training, or different sorts of information, different sorts of assistance, and so forth, how do people behave and does this affect the take-up, whether they use the intervention or not? Well, we can look at this in two ways. One is to consider that this allows for a better understanding of behaviors, given that in a certain number of cases, the results challenge misconceptions in development economics. For example, the fact that the poor will not be sensitive to the price of microcredits. This is one of the key arguments of Jonathan Mordock's chapter. One can also look at this in another way and consider that ultimately those kind of RCTs are similar to social marketing. By this I mean how to better distribute or sell a product which we believe has a social positive impact, but in fact, in a number of cases, we still don't know. Well, if you consider development as an aggregation of macro interventions, that's fine, but the impact issue remains unanswered. And if you consider development as transformative politics, this is more problematic. The third point has to do with ethics. Of course, any kind of research entails ethical issues. The thing is that RCTs are more concerned than observational studies since they manipulate the environment they study. A number of ethical standards do exist and have been designed by various declarations and reports. Informed consent, do no harm principle, provision of specifically considered protection for vulnerable populations, and so forth. In many cases, randomistas ignore those standards, and we still have recent examples. Why it is so? A number of chapters in the book deal with the ethical issue, and one is entirely focused on ethics, the chapter by Abramovich and Safars, who come both from the economical and the medical world. And the answer is quite simple. There is a trade-off between ensuring the internal validity of the protocol on the one hand and guaranteeing the protection of the experiment subject on the other hand. And quite often the first prevails over the second. Do we advance science or do we protect the people? As a way of conclusion, let me get back to the issue of controversy. Randomistas avoid the controversy, and this book is an example of this, but there are many others. At the same time, we must admit that they listen and adapt. This is a key argument of Tim Ogden's chapter. The thing is, quite often, this adaptation means even more complex protocols. And as long as the bottom of the problem, which has to do with epistemology and this strong belief in the purity of the protocol, as long as this problem has not been solved, we remain pessimistic about their ability to really respond to criticism. Yet, this controversy is crucial. It is crucial because it is the only way to advance science. It is also crucial given a number of crowding out effects in terms of methods, in terms of resources, also in terms of interventions. This is particularly the case in the field of global health, as one of the chapter shows. It is to be hoped that this book will help to move forward in this direction, and the current crisis, which largely confirms the limits of the method, will certainly move this debate forward, and tonight's event might be the first step. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, François and Isabel. That introduction makes me want to read the book. And I suspect we will have some controversy tonight. And if we want more of it, we can have another event, which the LSE will be happy to host. All right, now we move on to our respondents and discussants. And the first discussant is Lan Pritchett. Lant, the floor is yours.
Okay, I am sharing my screen. So I'm not going to exactly conform to the role Andres is proposing. I'm actually going to discuss kind of one narrow issue, which was my chapter in the book, but which I think is at the heart of one of the main controversies vis-a-vis RCTs and the role in the field of development. So what I'm going to talk about, the authors have reviewed sort of the broad scope of the book, which I think makes the book super interesting. I was interested by all the chapters, seeing the different sectoral perspectives, the disciplinary. I'm not going to talk about the technical issues around RCTs with Angus Deaton on the same panel. I have neither a comparative nor absolute advantage. So I'm going to just address the question of, like, one of the claims of the RCTs is this was a cost-effective way to actually improve human well-being in development, and that it was more cost-effective than other modes and types of research. And in particular, they have constantly kind of attacked the idea that one should research the larger questions, or that there was any possibility that research on the larger questions, like of the transformational nature, that could be effective at all. So the question is, can one believe that RCTs are a more reasonable, can one reasonably believe they're a more cost-effective way, not necessarily at writing papers, but of actually improving human well-being? And I think the answer is a clear and persuasive no. And it comes to a fundamental disagreement about often what we mean by the word development. I'm an old school development person, where we always understood development as a transformative process of countries. Countries, as they emerged into independence in the post-World War II period particularly, were transforming themselves economically, transforming themselves politically, transforming themselves administratively, the capability of the government and the state and its organizations to carry out, and were transforming themselves socially. And that fourfold transformation was what people meant as development. And importantly, it was a process that happened to societies and countries, and it wasn't strictly individuated. But there was a very strong belief that countries that were successful in the national development transformation on these four dimensions would also therefore be successful in achieving higher levels of human well-being. Turns out that view was exactly right. It was righter than you could have ever imagined. So my argument, and so if you ask, is human well-being primarily determined by national development or by programmatic and superior knowledge and designed programmatic efforts within a given context of national development? The answer is pretty much all national development. National development just turns out to be overwhelmingly the most important determinant or correlate at this stage, but anyway, correlate of the human well-being outcomes we're after. So as I will discuss, the correlation of the standard poverty measures with the kind of aggregate income of the country is essentially one. There isn't a country that has, in fact, succeeded in reducing poverty without succeeding simultaneously in transforming the economy towards a more broad-based, prosperous economy. So, therefore, since national development is overwhelmingly the factor that produces improvements in human well-being, the argument against research must be that somehow research into how to promote national development is worthless for a variety of reasons. Now, that argument is mostly entirely kind of speculative, but moreover, the differences in the magnitude between the gains that can be had from getting national development right versus wrong, versus the differences in the magnitude of the gains that are had from the programmatic efforts is so huge that essentially, and I argue this in the paper in the book, that you would have to argue that research into the national development issues is completely, totally worthless in order for it not to be more cost effective, because a small chance of a very large outcome is more cost effective than a large chance of a small outcome. So the first thing, and this is, I think if you take away one thing from what I say, this is just, if you look across all countries and episodes, this is the standard World Bank data on poverty. And if you look at the connection between the median consumption in the country and the headcount poverty rate at various headcount poverty rates, ranging from the extremely low dollar a day standard, which is now $1.90, to a higher $5.50, what you see is that the correlation between the income of the median person in the country and the poverty headcount rate is just extraordinarily tight over nearly the entire range. The correlation for the $5.50 poverty rate and the poverty and the median is 0.994. Like, you just don't generate correlations like this. Often, cross-country measures of the same concept don't achieve that level of correlation. So, to some extent, if you say, how much can we push down, how much can we reduce poverty without sort of the transformative effect of increasing the income for the typical person, there is some scope for it. We have no idea if any of this deviation is correlated with superior anti-poverty programs, much less correlated with having achieved those programs for an RCT. So, the first thing is, national development produces poverty reduction, full stop. There's just no evidence that the kind of small programmatic RCT type interventions play any significant or have played any significant role. And basically, broad-based improvements in per capita income are a necessary and sufficient condition for poverty reduction, basically. No country has low poverty without high median income. No country with high medium income has high poverty. So it's a necessary and sufficient condition for poverty reduction. Moreover, the same relationship, by the way, holds and changes over time. So this isn't just a cross-sectional effect. Changes over time, if you look at the change in poverty rate and the change in median consumption, have exactly the same thing along a 45-degree line. All of the country episodes are very tightly spaced. In fact, when we have seen growth, we have seen poverty reduction, and when we've seen poverty reduction, we've seen growth, and vice versa. Moreover, this same sort of tight correlation between national development and extends to other measures of human well-being. The Social Progress Index was an interesting example, because a group of people said, we dislike using GDP per capita as a metric for development, so we're going to create an index of development completely free of GDP per capita based on, 16 different sub-indicators of what are widely regarded as dimensions of human well-being. Well, if you add it all up and then say, how highly correlated is the Social Progress Index, which was constructed in some sense to not be driven by the standard measures of national development, you find that, again, national development is a necessary and sufficient for high levels of the Social Progress Index. Countries that have high levels of national development uniformly have very high levels of social progress, of the Social Progress Index, and vice versa. And basically, the scope for movements within that relative to the scopes for movements along national development are just massive. So, and I want to emphasize that my broad conception isn't just about growth. I'm not just saying it's development's about growth. I'm saying development's about this overall political, economic, administrative, and social transformation. And I'm sometimes just focusing on growth, because growth is one dimension that economists obviously spend a lot of time on. But you might say that, okay, yeah, we'll admit that these poverty programs aren't the major determinants. If you look at the poverty reduction in Vietnam, the poverty reduction China, the poverty reduction in Indonesia, they're clearly not driven to any extent by more aggressive or more successful poverty programs. Are driven by rapid improvement in average or median income. you could say, oh, yeah, that's all true, but we shouldn't do research about this because growth's just a constant and we can't affect it. You know, physicists don't do research on faster than light travel because their best theories say it's impossible, or electron mass is a constant of the universe. We don't research how we would change it. That's obviously false. Growth does, in fact, change dramatically over time within countries. We see episodes of rapid growth and episodes of boom and bust in nearly all countries in the world. Second, you could say, well, yeah, growth changes, but it has nothing to do with policies or actions by government. Again, completely implausible as a claim that we shouldn't research what actions government can take because government actions are ineffective with respect to growth. All of the standard narratives and much of the evidence can point to the determinants of growth changes. But then we could claim, well, growth changes. It does have to do with policies and actions of government, but research can't identify reliably what those policies are, or that growth changes, it's related to policy. Research can identify them, but the research is unpersuasive. I think all of these, I'm skipping some slides, I think all of these are sort of, again, arguments that could be made, but have never been fleshed out to any magnitude. Let me go back to just one of these slides. In the sense that we have to come back to the magnitude of the potential gains from getting the growth process right are just huge. This is the results of a paper that I was involved in earlier where we identified growth episodes and we identified the largest sort of growth episodes. And in the large, and then we calculated the NPV, how much relative to a counterfactual, what output would have been without the acceleration. And we see that the NPV of the gain in the large episodes was as much as 6 times of original GDP per capita. And if you look at the NPV gain from the growth episode per person, the typical person in Thailand gained $11,000 in PPP in NPV from the growth episode. That was initiated in Thailand in 1958, 15,000 for the episode in Korea that began in 1962, $7,000. These magnitudes are just massive relative to the premise or promise of anything that has been evaluated as a micro intervention, which again, is not that surprising for reasons we can go into. So let me just conclude by saying the balance is between the promise of a sure but small gain versus uncertain but large gains. And this all depends on the magnitudes of respects and gains and uncertainties. I would argue the gains from success at national development for human well-being are just orders and orders of magnitude larger than anything that's possible from more effective programs conditional on development. Mostly what RCTs, I think, have focused on and promise is kind of how can we mitigate the consequences of the lack of development rather than holding any promise or premise of providing more effective advice about development? And finally, with all of the issues that can be raised about the reliability of the RCTs themselves, moreover their applicability at scale, moreover their external validity, how much the lessons from one can be drawn from one to the other, I think we're in a case where research into national development issues both has orders of magnitude larger scope for gain and roughly have the same reliability in terms of your ability to generate reliable and useful advice. So in that sense, I would think the premise of RCTs as a mechanism of doing, promoting, and improving development in a way that improves people's lives around the world has been totally, completely wrong in that it has focused research on entirely the wrong set of issues and has not, in fact, delivered on the promise at all of being able to provide reliable research in its own right. So I think the fundamental thing is, do we believe that the national development process is going to produce countries that stand on their own and become full-fledged partners in the global scene, or do we really think development is exclusively about micro interventions that are going to mitigate the worst consequences of these countries having failed to achieve development. And I continue to think there's promise and optimism that most countries can in fact achieve development, and better advice rather than worse advice based on a range of methods and a continued focus on issues around growth, around political transformation, around administrative transformation is going to produce better results for the world than the RCT revolution can possibly hold out. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lant. We were talking about controversy a minute ago. I think we have some elements of the discussion that might follow. And now we move on to Professor Sir Angus Deaton. Angus, the floor is yours. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here, and it's great to be able to participate in this undertaking, which is trying to move the needle a little bit. And here's an outline of what I want to talk about. This started a long time ago, as François talked about, and I'd seen early drafts of most of the chapters, and I was prompted to take up a few issues where I could say something that I thought needed to be said. And then that became sort of an introduction. I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about what RCTs can and cannot do. I have a paper last year in Social Science and Medicine, and it's almost the whole issue of Social Science and Medicine, with the philosopher of science, Nancy Cartwright, which is much broader than the things I can talk about today, and which covers medical trials as well as trials in development, for example. And I'm going to revisit a few of these issues. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about what RCTs can do, and that if people understood better those misunderstandings, or they misunderstood, we might get back to a more sensible approach to things. I have a few things I want to say that I think ought to make randomistas a little bit uncomfortable, even if they think the rest of it's nonsense. I'm going to talk about causality and RCTs. Causality, a greatly misunderstood concept. And mostly I want to say something about ethics of RCTs in development, of which, in my view, there's been much too little discussion. I'll probably finish up going to a place much further than my editors or Lant would be comfortable with. So start with, well, one of the things that bothers me is all through my academic life, which has now gone on for an unconscionable length of time, more than half a century, I've always been harassed by people who put methods before substance. We don't have institutes for instrumental variables or factor analysis, just to take an example. Though I don't suppose anyone in the audience is old enough to remember the LSE in the 1970s, where we used to joke it was the London School of Autocorrelation, because it seemed like most of the work that was coming out of the economics department there was by autocorrelation of one sort or another. But put more substantively, I don't understand why J-PAL only does RCT, which sort of backs into what Lant was saying too. If you're concerned with poverty reduction, why would you say we're only interested in poverty reduction if we can attack it with an RCT? It makes no sense. And I don't think J-PAL, can really think of itself as a dedicated to poverty reduction if it ties its hands in this way, and we're only going to use these particular methods. On the other side, it's not true that a study that involves an RCT is necessarily a high-quality study. And I see that all the time. Someone was reviewing literature the other day. Excuse me. And on every slide that referred to a different study, he had a little rosette on the top. And that rosette was a sort of star to say, this is an RCT, which is supposed to make you believe the study, I think. A lot of people will say that RCTs in development have proved themselves, because there's been a lot of good studies. I think part of the problem with that is that people tend to judge the quality of the study by whether it's an RCT or not. So that's an entirely circular argument. One of the things I argue in the paper is that there, all of the econometric and statistical problems that we've always wrestled with are present in RCTs. RCT gives you no pass, which says you're exempt from all these problems that we've always worried about in econometrics and applied work. So here's a story that changed my mind. I was at a seminar in a European country that will remain nameless, in which young scholars, many of them really good, were presenting their studies. And this was a study about some African country, maybe the DRC, I don't really remember. And it was evaluating a treatment that had been applied in some provinces, but not others. So I don't know, there were 25 or 30 provinces, and five or six of them had got the treatment and the other one had not. Now, lots of journals nowadays ask you to have a weaknesses section at the end of your paper, right? Which are very interesting to read because people don't really want to admit to them. And usually they're not really weaknesses, but hidden strengths. And in this weakness center, the author said that the study would have been even better if the problem provinces had been randomly selected, you know? So I thought, wait a minute. What happens if the selection had been exactly the same as the selection in the paper, right? Which is certainly one of the possible randomizations that would come out of the thing. So even if the same province has been selected, the analysis in the paper would have been word for word identical. Every table would have been the same. Everything else would have been exactly the same. And yet it would have been a much better study. You know, this makes no sense at all. And it does suggest there's some deep misunderstanding going on here if randomization is automatically better, even if you get the same results. Now, one of the misunderstandings there is the balance problem, that many people who do these trials really believe that randomization constructs two otherwise identical groups. And when you read press reports or standard reports of any sort of RCT paper, they start off by saying, well, randomization guarantees that the only difference between the two groups is the treatment. Well, that's just not true. And you can obviously convince yourself by saying, okay, I stand in front of my class, I pick two people at random and then two other people at random. They're not identical people. They're different people. And you say, okay, that's because you have a small sample, but that doesn't really help you because what you really need to get balanced is all the causes that are going on. And so the causes that are operating have to be in the same in the two groups on average. And there could be millions of causes going on. And so no matter how big a group you choose, I can always choose a bigger number of causes which are going to defeat your balance. So randomization never guarantees a fair two groups. That's just a misunderstanding. It's wrong. It does, however. And Fisher, in his original work on agricultural fields and testing, noted that the point is that if you randomize, you have a statistical basis, a probabilistic basis for actually calculating whether you get a chance result, whether it came about by chance or not. So that's what randomization does. It doesn't give you fair choice. It gives you a standard error. But then it turns out that that inference can be fragile. Now, one of the big arguments about RCTs is they're sort of non-parametric. You don't have to make all the assumptions that we're used to making in applied work and getting very uncomfortable about. But for standard errors, that's not true. You need to make assumptions. And in particular, skewness, which means, you know, there's some people who do very, very well at this experiment and a few that don't do it, many that don't do well at all, which people often argue is what happens in microfinance. You know, you get one or two geniuses who turn themselves into Bill Gates and everybody else just wastes the money, then that's a disaster because your standard error is going to be wrong. You're going to look like it's significant when it's not significant at all. So you need assumptions. Many people have argued that we should use Fisher's randomization inferences, which is a non-parametric method, but even it can be fooled by an unfortunate sample. And what's more is it only tests the null that all the treatment effects are zero, whereas often what you want to know in practice is that the average treatment effect is zero, and it can't tell you that. So let me talk about perhaps the most controversial bit. It's contrary to common belief, no randomized controlled trial can by itself establish causality. you get learned something about causality, but you can't establish causality based on an RCT or even a group of RCTs. Heckman quotes Havelmo and Frisch as having clearly seen that causality is in the mind, it's not in the data. Now, let me just give you some examples. First of all, there's standard errors on these things, right? So it's always possible, however small the p-value is, that the result was generated by chance. Secondly, there's always some untestable assumption on which the result depends. Now, one example is you've got a really well-run experiment, but somehow your hand was tipped in the control group. So they knew they were in the control group as opposed to knowing they were in the treatment group. And that's going to mess things up in a way that has nothing to do with the treatment. Another example, and I give a very simple example in the book, you can get a significant positive effect when you measure the outcome in levels, but not in logs. You can flip the sign by measuring income or log income, for instance. So, you know, which one's causal? You can say this treatment is causal for log income, but it's not causal for income. That seems to challenge what people think they're talking about when they talk about causality. There's a very fine paper by Brad Broadbent, who's a philosopher, Van den Broek, who's perhaps the most distinguished epidemiologist working today, and Pierce, who's a philosopher and epidemiologist. It says causal conclusions do not follow deductively from data without a strong set of auxiliary assumptions. And these assumptions are themselves not deductive consequences of the data. So you cannot get from the data to a causal conclusion. And what they say is the totality of evidence that leads to a verdict of causality. Causality is a scientific conclusion, a theoretical claim, and as such transcends any individual study. That should be brazened on the wall everywhere where people are doing RCTs. And there's this very odd thing. People are very keen on putting the word causal in their titles these days. This never used to happen because most economists were scared of causality because it was the people like philosophers who understood this would come after them. And now it's everywhere. You scatter around in your study. I think what they think it means is that it's generalizable, which is obviously not true. And one of the things I can never quite pin down, but if you read Michael Kramer's Nobel lecture or his piece in the EAR, it's clear he thinks that once you've randomized, it's generalizable, that randomization reveals the truth, and therefore that's you're done anywhere, everywhere, anywhere, so and so on. So let me come to my, perhaps the thing I care about the most is ethical issues. Now, you usually get the answer, we can leave these to institutional review boards, human subjects committee. And the answer there is no, you can't get a free ethical pass just because your study went through an IRB. I'm not saying it shouldn't go through an IRB, but that doesn't exempt you from doing horrible things. For one thing, I've sat on IRBs and I can tell you, you get different decisions from the same board on different days on the same project. And that's as it should be. They're not operating by a set of rules, otherwise you really wouldn't need them. IRBs are often not independent of the investigators. If you go to, there used to be something in America called the Yellow Pages, which I don't think exists anymore. But if you go to the Yellow Pages, you used to find a section for IRBs. You could get an IRB to approve your study, just pay them to do it. But then when you come to development, one of the things we worry about in development is that many governments are not really acting in the interest of their people. They're more or less predatory, or, you know, there's an imperfect connection between people, between rulers and their people. So weak or corrupt governance in many countries extends to the review procedure, okay? So you really think, you know, if you went to Venezuela, for instance, the IRB would be worth the paper it was written on. Now, we're not doing these in Venezuela, but I'm very skeptical of IRBs being out in India, for example. There's stories of mass churning out of IRB certification and so on. So there's a real question as to whether these things are properly protected at all, even as far as IRBs go. But the truth is that researchers need to accept ethical responsibility for their own experiments. beneficence, which is one of the key criteria, is not satisfied by thinking you know what is good for others. And that's all over this literature. You know, people are not really care what the subjects think. They know what's good for them. And this is particularly problematic, and this is sort of getting to the core of what I've been thinking about. If these people are not your fellow citizens and have no recourse or claim on you, then it becomes really, really difficult indeed. I'll come back to that. So one of the things that's troubled me too is that, okay, that experimenters are better educated, richer, and more likely to be white than the people who are experimenting on. Almost all of this literature is about experiments done by rich people on poor people. In the US, if you look at MDRC and the history of poverty experiments over the last half century, they seem more concerned in the end by minimizing the cost of minimal treatment than actually supporting the poor. The poor's welfare is never much of a target there. Within the US, and this is a big issue, one of the things that people say to me all the time is, they say, well, Google's doing experiments on you all the time. Amazon's doing experiments on you all the time. The airlines change their prices randomly every morning or every 7 hours. I don't know how frequently it is. Or if I'm talking to one of the randomistas, they say, I'm doing experiments on you all the time, you know, because I'm in league with Uber and we're changing the prices all the time. But the difference there, there's a huge difference there, because you can call Facebook or Google in front of Congress and do things to them. So we're living in a society where there's some democratic control over the experimenters. So the experimentees, the people who are being experimented on, have some pushback to the people who are doing the experiments. Now, that is just not true for the World Bank, for example, or to universities, researchers in rich countries who are doing experiments on poor countries. There's a recent literature which was spurred by the Nobel Prizes, which I think was great. There's a labor experiment published as a Bureau working paper in which the experimenters induced people to undermine the solidarity of other workers in one of the very poorest areas in India. And since there was a minimum wage law there, they were almost certainly enticing people to break the law. There's a recent huge fuss over a paper in which World Bank researchers or academic researchers funded by the World Bank disconnected water supply in Nairobi in a poor slum. There have been experiments that affect the outcome of an election, which people find very disconcerting. In the US, if I were to try and do experiments on prisoners or children, I would have to jump through all sorts of special loopholes, and that's because they have limited autonomy, because they don't have any pushback on me. And yet the poorest people in the world who don't have any pushback on me, the World Bank doesn't make you go to an IRB at all, or it make you go through an IRB in the country where they're handing out money. So I have come to think too that politics is a really central thing here, and part of randomized controlled trials is part of what Bill Easterly likes to call the technocratic illusion, and has been the besetting sin of external economic development from the beginning, particularly like Charles Ferguson's book, The Anti-Politics Machine. Development agencies nowadays like to use the word partnership a lot, but partnership is worth nothing if all the money's on one side. You just get people adopting pleasing positions. There's no such thing as finding out works can unconditional on the environment and local politics. The word rigor doesn't seem to mean anything at all, but even if you had a perfect experiment, it tells you nothing about how to use its results. And my friend and collaborator Jean Grez has a very nice hypothetical example. He said, you do an RCT on schools in India, you discover that giving kids eggs, the kids in vegetarian places often are not very well nourished, and it promotes nourishment and learning. So you do a lovely RCT. So then there's a policy which says the school eggs program. And as he notes, well, what about the groups that oppose eggs? The vegetarian lobby is very powerful in India. What about the lobbyists for the poultry industry or the dried eggs manufacturers, or even someone who's going to manufacture substitute And you'll have the biscuit manufacturers on your heels the next day saying, you know, there's nothing so great about eggs. I have this great biscuit here. And to make policy requires politicians and coalitions, not just evidence. Evidence is important for policy. But this idea that evidence-based policy is you do an RCT and you take the results and then the results automatically go into policy is just really nonsense. There's a controversy in India recently over the food system and the giving cash instead. And one of the things that's become very apparent there is that even if the paper is pretty clear and clean, the authors then cherry pick results. And so do politicians. So the belief as to what is shown in the experiment is very different from what it actually showed. So this is my last slide. This is a nice quote, unfortunately, in an email from my ex-human friend, Dean Spears. He said, RCTs provide a ready and high status language that allows mutual legitimization among funders, researchers, and governments, but not at all among the people who are being experimented on. And funders love the rigor. I've talked to important funders, and they couldn't define rigor. You know, if rigor came and sat on their head, they wouldn't know what it was. And when I say that these experiments are wrong, they say, yeah, they probably are wrong, but they're much more rigorous than any other way of funding development, so we would use them. That will come to a bad end in the end, because it's not going to generate results. Now, let me just finally say, nothing here applies to all uses in all cases. RCTs often introduce variation that is otherwise not possible. And so you can learn something. And Jonathan Mordick, in his chapter in this book, makes the point that one of the things that RCT does is they're experiments. And so it's sort of like kick it and see sort of idea. The trouble, of course, is experiments don't require randomization. And physicists who, you know, do experiments all the time never use randomization, for instance. So you can kick something and see, but kicking it randomly is typically not a very good idea, especially if it comes back and gets you. One of the things, obviously, I've been thinking about recently is, you know, all these randomized controlled trials that are going on right now on COVID vaccines, are those what we should be doing? Or do some of the critiques apply to them too? So I just leave you with one final thought, which is that randomization, you know, I remember when my kids were teenagers and I asked them to do something they didn't want to do, they would tend to say, that is so random. Mm-hmm. Random was an insult. They thought random was one of the worst things that you could possibly do. And it is a bad thing to do, because the rule should be, if you can control for all the things that matter, you should control them. And randomization is a last resort strategy. And that's often been forgotten. So that we should be doing much more purposive selection, if you like, stratification. And that's not frequently enough discussed. The randomization leaves a huge amount to chance. And if you can reduce that, you're going to get better results. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Angus, for those wonderful and provocative remarks. I have two teenage daughters, and they also use random as an insult, so I think that has not changed. I want to encourage people who are listening to feel free to send questions. My screen is telling me there are 112 participants out there. We have one or two questions, but probably not as many as we are going to need or want. But while people do that, let me just use my chair's privilege and ask maybe two questions. Lant made the very strong point that RCTs focus on the wrong thing. They focus on the micro when poverty reduction really mostly comes from getting the big things right. Once you get the big things right, poverty reduction follows. And Angus made a related point, which is that you don't just need evidence, you need politics, you need coalitions, you need persuasion. by implication, I think he was saying, the kind of evidence that RCTs seem to produce are not very useful or persuasive when it comes to political debate. So I want to ask, just dig a little bit deeper into those two statements. And of course, this is not aimed at anywhere in particular. You know, the editors might want to come in as well. Are we stuck in the sense that this methodology only allows evidence on little questions to crop up, and as a result, that evidence is not going to be ever persuasive in political debates, which tend to traffic in big ideas? Or is there something we could do? Could we use this methodology? I don't quite know how, but I'm sure, you know, cleverer people than I might think of it, to tackle some of those better questions, which, to Angus's point, may be more relevant in political debates. Have the randomizers done something wrong, or is the methodology just inevitably limited? I see Lant raising his finger.
I mean, I think the idea that technical knowledge of program design is the binding constraint for real world governments in achieving better results is a kind of premise that, A, on many, many dimensions is demonstrably false, in the sense that it's demonstrably false that the governments are in fact already doing everything they know, and hence the binding constraint to better performance is something they don't know. And second, it kind of, a lot of this presumes that these governments and their organizations already have in some sense the purpose for which the RCT is designed. So one of the origin stories of RCTs was a RCT done between some of the J-PAL researchers and an NGO in India. But talking to the head of that NGO, when he took these results about what could be done to improve learning in schools in this district to the government civil service, who was nominally in charge of running education in the district, and described the results of this experiment, the top civil servant literally looked at him and said, "Who cares? Like, what do you think my job is? My job is not to improve the learning performance of students. My job is to implement the policies that I have from the government." Right. And, you know, pointed around his office at piles and piles of files and things. And he says, "I work 60 hours a week and more responding to complaints and pressures, and none of them are addressed by what you've given me." So the head of the NGO realized, until he changed the motivations and purposes that were conceived of by the government as important, kind of providing technical knowledge that if you did more of Y, you would get more of X, when the problem as framed by the government and its organizations isn't achieving X, is pointless. And I think a lot of that is this bias that knowledge was the constraint, which is just demonstrably false.
Angus, and Isabel, I think you both want to come in on this one.
Thanks. I just want to make a couple of points, and also in response to one of the questions and answers. Evidence is really hard. Science is really hard. Finding out things is really hard. So, you know, one of the things I find most difficult about RCTs is it sort of bypasses that somehow. It says we have this magic engine which we can roll out and find out anything, and it works everywhere. And that overstates the role of any evidential procedure. Evidence is always valuable. And, you know, or sometimes it's valuable. I mean, Andrews himself said you never actually did anything that was based on an RCT. And that seems to be right. I should also point out, you know, perhaps slightly against Lant, that we don't know much about growth either, right? So if we say we should be doing these big things, yeah. I think we're much better on the big things of knowing what not to do. You know, handing your country over to a communist dictatorship is probably a bad idea in terms of growth. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's lots of stuff like that that seems, or having a hyperinflation, or, you know, having exchange controls. I think there's a lot of things we've learned about things like about central banking, for instance, that are much better conducted. And, you know, African central banking, for instance, is much better than it used to be. And none of that knowledge comes from RCTs. And for the reasons that Rand gave, and I agree with them, I think small changes in knowledge and practice at the macro level have a much better chance of improving human welfare. I would just let me interject one thing which I'd like people to think about. One of the things that's really interesting in the COVID pandemic, and you can look at this in our world of data and so on, the hurt that's being caused here per capita is entirely negatively correlated with per capita income. And like Lent, I'm a great believer that everything's positively correlated with per capita income, but COVID is going exactly the other way. It may be a temporary thing, may not be a temporary thing, but it's a very, very interesting thing that, you know, America and Britain are doing incredibly badly here, right, whereas countries like the Central African Republic are doing just great.
Thank you. I'm going to hand it over to Isabelle and Francois, but I just want to say that the first point that Angus made reminds me of the advice I was given when I became a minister by a predecessor in the job who said, you will spend 80% of the time trying to prevent bad ideas from becoming policy and only 20% of the time trying to get your own good ideas into policy. And I think that very much matches your remark, Angus. Isabel, floor is yours.
Yeah, I would say that even for micro questions, I have criticism regarding what RCT can achieve. Let's take the example of microcredit. You know, there is this special issue of the American Economic Journal, was bringing together six RCTs, and which, as Francois said earlier, is considered today as a final word on the topic. No? Let me just give you examples. One of the most salient results is the low take-up, which also raise other problems, because when you have a low take-up, you really struggle to prove anything. But yeah. So this result is an interesting one, because still today you have a number of practitioners, decision makers, and who still predict an unlimited market, no, in the field of microcredit. The thing is that, first, others have said that earlier. Second, the true significance of the numbers are, in fact, limited and even useless, I would say, for two reasons. The fact that the thing is that, the first is that in each country, they have calculated a certain level of take-up, but the interpretation of this figure is impossible, simply because, and here we are back to the sampling issue, because we in order to be sure to have virgin populations, RCTs had to go to extremely specific areas or specific populations. So what are those people representative of? No one knows. So at the end of the day, we have a low take-up, but the figure in itself does not mean anything. And moreover, the RCTs say nothing about the reasons behind this low take-up. Is it because the supply is of poor quality, or is it because people simply don't want microcredit? We don't know. Maybe another short point. No, the one of the key arguments is to say, well, the poor are not all entrepreneurs, which is another key result. First, well, anyone who knows a bit about the topic knows about that. It has been argued for long by political economists, by anthropologists, and so forth. And the other thing is, so there is nothing new in this argument. And the more fundamentally, the main question asked by randomisters, does microcredit work or not, is not the right question. So we are back to the fact that even at the micro level, the question is, according to me, the wrong one. For practitioners, because RCTs are claiming to help practitioners, the key question is, for whom does it work, where, and under which conditions? Responding to these kind of questions require a very different conception of causality mechanisms and a clear analysis of the role of microcredit in value chain processes, in the creation of wealth at the regional level, at the sectoral level, I mean, a number of questions that RCTs are unable to address. And maybe if I may, a very last, very quick illustration, gender. I mean, the ministers are claiming to assess the impact of this or that in terms of gender equality. And usually the indicator which is used is the impact in terms of decision-making within the household. Well, why not? But I mean, assuming that gender inequality is a matter of decision-making within the household is extremely problematic or even dangerous. For these few examples, to say that even at a micro level, I have doubt regarding the ability of RCTs to give any new answer or a proper answer.
Thank you. François, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Andres. I want to elaborate a bit on what has been said. I think that in this panel, we more or less all agree on the limitation of RCTs. It's not the good answer in methodological term. I mean, that's the only solution. In policy issues, and also on the democratic front. So my question is, maybe we can discuss with the audience about this, but at least at the panelist level, we agree on this. So how to push the frontier further? The first question for me is, how could all this happen? How this hegemonic position has been, in spite of this limitation we quoted, how could it be that the RCT gained the first and hegemonic position? And does economy as a discipline can answer this question? That's the first point. The second point is how we can change the state of the positions on the market for economy. And here again, I don't know how, and is it up to the economy to answer this question? Angus said that why I don't understand why J-PAL only do RCT. I think that maybe you know, maybe you've got some intuitions, and I would like you to get your intuition, but maybe also you think that, I'm sure you're convinced it's a scientific question, but maybe economy can't answer this. Or up to now, economy has nothing to say about it. But I think it's a key question. And my last point is, where next for economic discipline? If politics is key to understanding the world, even from an economist point of view, if RCT is a wrong way to make research to transform the world, what have we got in the plate for economy in the next future? That's my question. I'm not considering myself as a potential answer for it because I'm going retired soon, so it will be for the next generation, like Lent and Angus. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left, and I think it is only fair that we should give our audience the possibility to ask a question or two. So let me just read one of these questions that just came in. It's from Martin House, who's a student at the LSC and the Department of Government. And Martin asks, do you think that the prominence of RCTs in development has to do with the preferences of funders, especially big philanthropies and Western governments who may have little interest in big transformative change? And if that is so, who ought to be in the business of funding the other more relevant research? Good political question.
You could say a little bit about that. It's clear that, and also I can address a little bit Francois' question about why J-PAL only does RCTs. And the answer is because it's been incredibly successful in getting funding, not to mention getting them 3 Nobel Prizes. And you know, so you can hardly doubt the success of the enterprise in terms of money and in terms of professional success. What is much harder to do is to justify it in terms of, you know, the welfare of people in the countries where they're really trying to help. and I'm very skeptical about that. I haven't, you know, read every paper they've written and tried to work my way through that. The trouble with that is that, and you know, economics is tends to be fickle. So, you know, if you've been at it as long as I have, you know, my first paper was published more than 51 years ago. The fads, you know, when I started out, everyone in economics was doing K-class estimation. I bet none of one here even knows what that is. But, you know, these are fads who sweep through the subject. And I think this is just one of the latest ones. And, you know, after all, in the 60s, it was a huge fad in economics to do randomized controlled trials. There were these huge social experiments. And they died then, and I think they'll die now. Now, funders are also very fickle, because the changeover among presidents and staff and funding agencies is very rapid, and they always want to do something different from what the people did before. And so I think you'll see this reaction. I should say, just, I'm a bit different from probably anyone here. I don't believe in development, right? So I don't believe that it's possible for one country or one agency to develop another country from the outside. And I think we should stop trying to do that. I think there are lots of things we can do to make life better for people in poor countries. But I think this technological illusion that Bill Easterly talks about is very, very real. We think of development as a technical problem and something that we can do to people. And I think that's profoundly unethical and profoundly wrong. And so I would abandon this whole enterprise, which I doubt the French Development Agency would want to do and so on. But I just wanted to state that position at some point. And to me, RCTs are a symptom of what is a really broken enterprise.
Thank you. Isabel, you want to come in on this as well?
Yeah, just 2 points. Yes, I think, and I think this is a point made by Lant also in his paper, the fact that the success of RCT is clearly, is both shaped by and constitutive of a deep transformation of the development world, with the growing role of private investment and but also foundation, NGOs, which in fact are the main partners of RCTs. And a deep transformation of the development world that juxtapose privatization of interventions and players, marketization, but also compassion, you know? And at the same time, since we are running after time, just another point in line with what François was saying, mm-hmm. The fact that the success, but also the abuses, the drawbacks on the perverse effect of RCTs, for instance, in terms of ethics, are also, I think, a symptom of a more broader problem, which is not only true at the randomista level, but the entire academia level. The race for productivity, the diktat publish or perish, which is known to shape the present academic world and cause many failings. And I think those examples, I mean, the ethical, anti-ethical examples that have been mentioned clearly show the limits of an academic system that no longer has a mean to assess the quality of the research conducted, both technically and ethically. So the success of RCT also expressed the problems, the broader problems of the academia, I would say. Yeah.
There's a question here from Hassan Ghali, who's a recent student at the School of Public Policy. He says, do we really need an RCT for learning that if we jump out of a plane, we need a parachute? Can RCTs tell us something useful for development that we did not know already? I think Lant might enjoy tackling that one. Lant?
You're muted, Lant.
Yeah, I'm unmuted. that's interesting because I remember Angus using exactly that same analogy about 12 years ago in a meeting with the randomistas. So there are some common sense things we know, and I think one of the big damaging effects of the RCT is basically this weird wiping the slate clean, as if no evidence that ever existed before was relevant, You know, one of the RCTs published in this top American economic journal, the RCT showing that if there were schools in some villages in Afghanistan and weren't some schools in others, enrollment was much higher where there were schools. And literally this paper was published with two total references to the entire previous literature, establishing the very obvious and common sense connection between distance to school and attendance, something that's been the premise of government policy and education for 100 years. So that said, I also think there are some interesting things that get learned from RCTs. It just usually isn't the clean causal impact of a program is that what's get learned. I think a lot of what we've learned from RCTs is the ways in which the RCTs themselves have failed. And from that, we actually learn interesting things. The randomistas tried to do an experiment with the police in a state of India where they were gonna subject the police captain to assigning his officers in this way versus that way to see what impact it had on the morale of the officers. And the main thing they learned is that after 18 months of the, or after the X months of the intervention, the treatment group and the control group were exactly the same on the treatment. They just, meaning the police force just wouldn't do what it was told to do under the experiment. I think we learned a lot from that. I think we've learned a lot from the failures of the experiments themselves, both either to get implemented and or how they failed to achieve the objectives. The problem with all of that learning is it's no more rigorous than anything else. You know, the mechanism learning, you know, the only thing that has any claim to rigor and even, you know, Professor Beaton doubts even a lot of that, but that blocks total impact. Whereas what we really have learned a lot from the RCTs is about, is the, in some sense, the stories and narratives of the ways in which the purposes of the RCT have been thwarted and undermined, and that points in sort of interesting directions, but it just means it's a broader participation in the general panorama of research rather than having any special claim to fame. So I think we've learned a lot actually from the randomistas been around there doing weird stuff, just none of it is what it's claimed to be.
One could summarize what you just said by saying that we have learned from their failures, not from their successes. Francois, I think you wanted to come in on this. We're out of time, but maybe we can take a minute or two before we call it a day. Francois.
Yeah, no, just to confirm Len's view, that I think that we should not throw the baby with the bathwater go out of this this panel with like anti-RCT fanatics. RCT is a tool. Is a tool in the toolkit of the economist and other political scientists. No, but what is problematic is the status which has been given to this tool. It's no better, no worse, and the quality and the pros and cons should be balanced. And that's why, but it's obvious, we are advocating for MMA, mixed method approach. Just to say a word on the previous question, so funder has been stressed, but the political economy of this successful business model is a conjunction of different actors and supply, and on the supply side, brilliant economies, trainings, a firm, J-PAL and others, but also the public audience in the north, with this idea of aid fatigue, corruption in the south, the desire of having more simple simplicity and modesty, which some of the randomista are taking the face. So I think that it's more complex, and we've got in the book some explanation of this political economy of the success. Thank you.
I cannot resist the temptation to ask for an unfair clarification from Angus Deaton before we say our goodbyes. Angus, you said you do not believe in development. And by that, I take it you meant you don't mean development as something that others foist upon you or upon your country. But as you were saying that, I was reminded that you did write a book called The Great Escape, in which you tell the tale of how the world has become wealthier and healthier and we all live much longer. So if it is not the Randomistas or the World Bank that is going to allow us to do that great escape again, who is it? And how do we...
I don't think the World Bank or the Randomistas did very much in the great transcendent story that I tell of the world getting much better. You know, the world got much better because we had amazing technical innovations, of which perhaps the greatest of all of those is the germ theory of disease. And, you know, that was not discovered in Lagos, and it was not discovered by a randomized controlled trial. I mean, it was discovered by a bunch of people in Europe and was very contested for a long time and eventually became sort of established science. So that causality there was fought over and contested for a very long time until it became accepted common knowledge. And then, you know, after the Second World War, that was taken to the rest of the world and has had huge positive effects on human welfare. So, you know, that's a big thing. I mean, I think smaller things are like central bank stuff that we talked about before, or better conduct of macroeconomic policy. And, you know, and all of that is the taking of ideas that were developed elsewhere and applying them within an indigenous political structure in which, you know, there are coalitions built or whatever, and they're adopted in particular countries. I mean, one of the troubles with the holiness that surrounds RCTs is that, and it was one of the questions in the question and answer thing too, was that, you know, politicians will then cherry pick the results from an RCT, and they may not be the right results at all, and the RCT may not have shown them, but by God, they were delivered by an RCT. And therefore, it's true. And that's a really worrying thing. But I think we can do a huge amount to help countries develop. And a lot of it would be by stopping doing the things like massive arms sales or heavy tariffs or things that we do that make it really hard for countries to develop. So I'm very much in favor of development. I'm a great beneficiary of development myself. You know, when I was born in Edinburgh, the infant mortality rate there was much higher than it is in India today, for example. And I like to think of that as an example of the things that have gotten much, much better. So thanks very much to all of you for inviting me.
Yes, this chance. No, thank you. Thank you, Angus. And thank you for answering that last question, which actually also came from an MPP student here at the LSE, James McDay. All right, everybody, I'm sure we could carry on because these are fascinating topics, but we are 5 minutes past our bedtime, or at least our ending time. I want to thank Isabel and Francois for bringing this book to the LSE, to this discussion. I guess it's not available for purchase yet, but it will be soon, right? So we will be looking for it. And to Lan Pritchard and Angus Deaton, thank you again very, very much. To all four of you, that was a fun conversation on very, very important topics. And I'm sure we have not said the last word. The conversation will continue. Good evening, everyone. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.